The army had come. For weeks, the reports had trickled into and out of the palace. The Persians were advancing. The Babylonian cities were falling, one by one, from the north to the south. Now they were around the capital. The king had fled, leaving his son, the prince, in the palace, and young, spoiled Belshazzar did not know what to do. He'd never been trained on attacking a besieging army, and now, outnumbered, in fact, most of his army gone, either destroyed, captured, or fled, surrounded, and clearly already defeated, Belshazzar panicked and ordered an act of sheer bravado to drown his fears. He held a banquet. When they were about to die, he called for the cups and plates and serving vessels captured from the Jerusalem temple, and tonight he would get roaring drunk with them. But when he had begun to drink, a hand appeared in the air against the wall he faced and wrote three words. Strange words, all of them names of weights. Mina, shekel, half. Now only he could see the hand. Only he could see the words. So his outcry of fear and trembling point and staggering collapse would but have caused a question among the revelers. What's wrong with the king? Still, he was king, if only for a short time. So his call for seers and interpreters was obeyed. But when he described to them what he had seen, no one could make sense of it. Ounce? Pound? Hundredweight? Would be something like it in English. How would you interpret that if somebody told you, I saw a hand writing in the air, and it wrote, ounce, pound, hundredweight? What does it mean?
I don't know. You need to go on a diet?
Don't know. Finally, Daniel was called for. And he interpreted the vision, because he knew the Hebrew God had caused to be written before Belshazzar's eyes. And he knew the verbs associated with these terms. Mina, the first word, that verb form was mene, which is the word that was written, and it means numbered or appointed. Tekel, it's a variant, actually, of the word shekel, but its verb means weighed or assessed. And parson, uparson, simply means and parson, so it's ounce, pound, and hundredweight is what was written. Parson has pres, which means shared, and it sounds very much like paris or Persian. God wrote what he knew Daniel could understand, and Daniel told him, King, your days are numbered. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting, and your kingdom is shared and given to the Persians. Now, this is not the first time Daniel has interpreted, and it is not the last time that he will tell the truth, no matter what. Can there be a starker contrast between truth and falsehood than this, the life of Daniel? Certainly there are others in Scripture just as strong, but that doesn't diminish this one. If anything, it strengthens it and places it alongside the other many ways we are shown and taught to live the truth, and how easy it is to live a lie. We have so many examples of that. Adam and Eve did it very easily, as has every generation since. Am I my brother's keeper? Why did Sarah laugh? Oh, I didn't laugh. Here's the coat we found. Is it Joseph's? Uriah, go home and enjoy yourself. I live among a people of unclean lips. What is truth? He says he's a king. Sure. Sapphira and I gave all the money. It's very easy to do that. But these are spectacular examples. There are others, quieter, more common, much more frequent, constant ones, in fact. I am a separate person, separate from you and from all others, and therefore I need to fear you, because if I am separate, you might do something to me. Something will go wrong. I am separate from the world, and therefore, if something goes wrong, you will laugh at me. I will do something wrong, and you will criticize me. so I must make myself safe and secure. A conclusion born of this lie. I must believe a doctrine fiercely and defend it with anger, so I will be right, because we are separate. I must do what will make you approve of me, so I will be safe and secure, because we are separate. And in this way, we are addicted to our fears, and instead of facing them and understanding them and dealing with them, we give in. We obey them, which only makes them stronger until they become tyrants, ordering our every act, every decision, shaping our every thought. Which is why Christians act just like non-Christians in most important ways. Because we give in to our human fears, which is exactly what everybody else does. We are locked into the prison of our fears, which are just that, fears. They're not true. They're not even real, except inside our own heads. And as long as we go through each day trying to make it go right, as long as we try to avoid what we fear will go wrong, we are self-centered, not living the truth, and therefore we cannot be free. Most Christians have not yet faced this truth, which is why most Christians still live by their fears, which is why most Christians just live just like non-Christians in every important aspect. And poll after survey has shown that. This is what everybody does, and therefore we do it too. The Israelites weren't the first ones to give in to the Canaanites. Nor were they the last. We have to learn not to do what everybody else does. We are told to not do what everybody else does. But that includes facing our fears. But we're too afraid to most of the time. Thus, we live by them. They become our masters, not God, for most Christians, and that kills our spiritual life. When we fear, we cannot know the truth. When we fear, we cannot know love. Therefore, we cannot know others. We can't know God's will. We can't even know God. We cannot love when we're busy trying to control things and people and relationships because we're separate, and we have to control things to my satisfaction and security and safety. So what do we do? Well, remember Micah 6:8? And what does God require of you? He has shown you, O man, what is good. What does God require of you but to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God? Remember that word translated humbly also means deliberately or guardedly. In fact, that's its basic meaning. So Micah tells us to walk deliberately with the Lord our God, he who tells us to love him with all our mind. Micah says the same thing. And how do we do that? By faith. Now, before you say, well, I've heard that before, remember, faith is much deeper and much more demanding than we think. It doesn't mean what we think it means most of the time. Here's what it really means. Jesus, in his wilderness temptation. Simple as that. When was the last time you read over and over again the story of Jesus' wilderness temptation and meditated on it and prayed over it and spent a whole day on that passage? And then ask yourself, are you willing to do as Jesus did there? Or at the other end of his life, are you willing, knowing what's coming, knowing the pain, knowing the death that is coming, are you willing to stand still and let it happen? Are you that courageous? That's what Jesus did. But at the beginning, at his wilderness temptation, he fasted for 40 days. He willingly endured temptation. He answered every temptation with a scriptural truth, none of which gave him the right to lash out or oppose or strike back or claim a promise. He didn't do any of that. When faced by the strongest attacks Satan had to offer, he didn't defend himself at all. He trusted in God and in his word and rested in both, standing still as a target for Satan's attack and resisting him only in love. It almost makes you wonder, does God love Satan as well? The answer probably is yes. Satan just doesn't accept it. Now, what do we do with that? Do we do what Jesus did? Stand still? Accept whatever happens? Trust in God? Or do we listen until we don't want to hear something and then stop listening, growing louder and angrier because, of course, he who has the last word wins? Or do you let everything happen to you and trust in God in it all? What do you think Daniel did? Daniel was called before the king. Can you interpret this? This is what I saw. Daniel did. Now, what person standing before a king wants to tell the king that his kingdom is ended, that he was not going to be king anymore? As a matter of fact, he'll probably be dead before long. And in fact, it was before the night was over. But he stood before the king and told him what God had told him, that his kingdom was ended. That took courage. That took faith. But he had it. And he did in what happened next as well. Now, what happens in the period of time between chapters 5 and 6, we don't know. How long a period of time it is between chapters 5 and 6, we don't know. But the Babylonian Empire had fallen, Persia had taken it over, and so the Persian Empire was now stretched unbroken in this huge arc across Asia. The Persians appeared to keep the Babylonian administrators in place, at least at first. Patton, as I understand, was criticized for keeping Nazi administrators in positions of power until they could make a smooth transition from one government to the next. Well, the Persians did it centuries before he did, and it worked then. So that's what they were doing. Daniel decided not just to keep, but after a time decided to promote, which angered his jealous fellow satraps, the governors of the empire. So they decided to find a way to bring him down. They tried to find corruption. That didn't work. Makes you wonder if they tried it themselves. There was no corruption in him. But instead of admiring him, though, you see what fear does, they looked for negligence, and they didn't find that either. But instead of admiring him, you see what fear does, instead of wanting the good of the empire, they hatch a plot to catch him by his religion. Since he will omit no duty, it seems, well, they would outlaw one of his duties. So they flatter the king, and they do it in a way that kings have enjoyed hearing for a very, very long time. They offer him a kind of semi-godhood, or at least a temporary godhood. Well, temporary is as good as any, better than some things. He's fairly new on the throne, and this might solidify his place on the throne. So it's a desire that he has. And when they ask for a law of limited time, of course, so there's no real harm to any religion that could possibly occur. So the king signs a decree making him a god for 30 days. As soon as he heard of it, Daniel knew the law's intent. But he did not change his prayer schedule. He prayed to God anyway, and publicly, too. Where Shadrach and company refused to commit a sin, Daniel refused to omit a duty. The heart was the same in both times. So he prayed, and the conspirators, no doubt grimly happy, marched off to the king to accuse Daniel. It was only then that the king realized what they had done. And boy, was he angry, but there wasn't a thing that he could do about it. He realized they'd tricked him into doing this. Legally, his hands were tied, because the entire empire was built on this agreement that an enacted law cannot be repealed. Once a law, always a law. Unless this one, like this one, it had a lifespan. So the king, because he doesn't have any choice, reluctantly sentences Daniel. Though, interestingly, and probably for the first time in his life, he prays that Daniel's God delivers him. And he spends an anxious night refusing food and something else. The word occurs only here in the Bible, and we really don't know what it means. But since it isn't important, it probably doesn't matter. At any rate, Daniel is fed to the lions, and the chamber is closed and sealed all night. And notice it's sealed with both seals, both the king's and the satrap's seal. So each watches the other. The next morning, the king commands the chamber opened, and there is Daniel, unharmed. Well, the king is very pleased, has Daniel removed, and then, of course, his lying accusers, who deliberately duped and used the king, were put in his place. They were not unharmed. Now, what might we learn from all of this? Because it's here for a reason. First, notice that Israel was once more a captive nation. Weren't they that once before? While not slaves this time, they were subjected to the life and the laws of the most powerful empire the world had ever seen. Not since Egypt had they been in such a position, which of course made them question. Now before, when they were in Egypt, they didn't even know God. Because when Moses had, God talked with Moses, Moses said, well, what's your name? So that when they ask, I can tell them. They knew that they had a God, they just didn't know anything about him. So Moses went and told them about him. It was a different case. Since then, they'd had God's promises, God's leading, both out of Egypt and into the promised land. God had saved them from so many things in the course of their history. They had the temple, they had the prophets, they had the law, and now this, which made them question. In all their history, and in the histories of those around them, battles were always won by the strength of their gods. I have occasionally wondered why history starts really with Homer's Iliad. It's an uncertain history, yes, and one peopled with meddlesome gods and goddesses whose favorites win when they themselves were dominant, when the gods were. And occasionally you'll find a case where, oh, say, Hera and Zeus are on different sides of the war, and Hera is not happy with Zeus being more powerful, so she gives him a drink and he falls asleep, passes out. Gods can do that, I guess. He passes out, and then Hera helps her side. When Zeus wakes up, he finds out what she's done, and he's not happy, but his side wins because now he's stronger. And so gods will do this. And it isn't just Greece that believes it. Everybody does. And that's why in the Bible you'll find one of the enemies of Israel saying, their gods are the gods of the hills, our gods are the gods of the plains, so if we fight in the plains, we'll win because our gods are stronger there. And that's what everybody thought. So what's Israel to think about their God when Babylon captures them and destroys everything, including the dwelling place of God? If Judah is conquered by Babylon, which is conquered by Persia, are not Persia's gods stronger? Says the Bible, not quite. God allowed Nebuchadnezzar to take Jerusalem, but he protected his people in Babylon, didn't he? And when Shadrach and friends prayed in Babylon, God heard them and answered, didn't he? God intervened in Nebuchadnezzar's own life unexpectedly in a way that his gods didn't or couldn't and certainly couldn't prevent. So who's really stronger, O Israel? God ordains Babylon's end the last night of Belshazzar's life and ordained a fast for the lions while Daniel sojourned among them. He even used the incident to awaken Darius to his existence. However dimly, Darius now knows something about God. And what Daniel says is that apparently there cannot be an emperor so mighty that he can live apart from God and his influences. At the end of 2 Chronicles, God moves Cyrus of Persia to release Jews to rebuild the Jerusalem temple. And we see in Daniel that he's active among his people even while they are in Persia. That's one of the rewards of doing what is right. You begin to hear and to understand things about God you did not know before. Because in order to do what is right, you have to stop doing what you're afraid of so you can hear what God is really saying to you, or you can see what other people really are like. When you're afraid, you can't know what others are like. You're too busy inside yourself. And eventually, God uses your desire to do what is right, your insistence to do what is right, as long as you're open to God and not sure that what you think is right is right. That's not following what is right before God. It's following what we think is right. It's another way of being afraid. Eventually, God uses what we do to His glory and to others' good, and others begin to think about your God. Now, not well at first, just like Darius. But then, neither did we at first. And sometimes still don't. But following Christ and Daniel, we do what is right. Not what we think, certainly not what we like and want, but what is right. Now, why not what we want? Because of what we talked about earlier. You're afraid of something. Simple as that. You're human. And so, you are. Now, I'm not talking about a diagnosable phobia, where we flee from frogs or refuse to walk through ferns. Did you know that Sigmund Freud was afraid of ferns? Maybe that's why he went into psychotherapy. But it's that slithering underground fear that I am separate from you and the rest of the world, and therefore I have to be afraid of you and the rest of the world. So I must control you and the rest of the world. Who was it who said most men lead lives of quiet desperation? Was that Thoreau? I think it was Thoreau. Either Thoreau or Emerson. I think it was Thoreau. Most men lead lives of quiet desperation. And that's what the Bible addresses over and over and over again. Because of that, I must control things. I must control you with doctrine, or anger, or threats, or manipulation of many kinds. I must control you because I'm afraid of being laughed at or rejected. We're afraid of any kind of suffering, large or small, and so we manipulate to avoid it. And even though Daniel shows us God at work even in our suffering, we still tend to do this because we've never read Daniel and then asked, "Is it me, Lord? Am I like Belshazzar or Nebuchadnezzar? Or like the satraps who betrayed Daniel?" If we asked that question and were honest about it, sometimes we'd have to say, now and then, yes, we are. Daniel 3 and Daniel 6, that is, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Daniel in the lion's den, have the same message as Job, don't they? They have the same message as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You are a believer, you are a child of God, and yet these things are going to happen, yet God is going to be with you in it all. That's what Job says. So why don't we listen? Because most of the time we're afraid to. But recognize that, and you've taken the first step to fixing it. Now, only the first step, because you must go on and do something about your fears, but admitting them is the necessary first step. If we're too afraid to admit that we're afraid, we'll never do anything about it. Do you know why Daniel can do what he does? And this is another reward for doing what is right. Daniel knows who he is. Fearful people don't. Not only do they not know others, they don't even know themselves. Now there's a reward for doing what's right for you. The truth will set you free. The truth will show you who you and others really are. Why does God tell us to honor each other above ourselves only so that we can see the truth about each other? You cannot see the truth about someone unless you love that person. Why does Proverbs tell us to keep seeking wisdom? Because we can never have enough. Christian, once we think we know enough, we stop learning. Because what happens when we think that we know enough? Why bother? Good enough is good enough. And as soon as we say that, we Christians stop growing, stop learning, and if we stop growing, we start to die. Never know enough, Christian, about anything. As long as you realize that you don't know enough, you will want to learn more. And you will begin to learn things about God's world that you had no idea existed. The world is a very strange place because it's so incredibly complex. Because that's the imagination of God. Much more complex than we know. Because the world is made by imagination. Think of that. What does imagination do? Now, imagination is not just fantasy. Imagination is doing things like, what would happen if I did something good for this person? What if I wanted to do something good for this person? What would I do? Well, this person likes A, B, and C, so I should do A, B, and D. And this person would like that, and it would make this person happy. That's the kind of thing imagination does. That's exactly the kind of imagination that made the world. It came from God Himself. And look at the place. And look at what's in it. It is more beautiful than we know. The only reason we haven't seen the beauty is because we haven't looked for it. When we look for it, we see it. I mean, how many times have the clouds lifted and the mountains on either side of us stood out in sharp relief against the sky? And we're absolutely awestruck. You can be that way before anything, whether it's the flash or color of a bird or the majesty of a mountain or a tree or anything. How small things are and beautiful. How large things are and beautiful. Is there no end to this beauty? There's no end to it in God's world because there's no end to it in God. And the only way we see that is if we never know enough. Never know enough. Never be satisfied with what you are. Be satisfied with what you have, but not with what you are. Not with what you know. Never be able to do enough right, enough good. Always strive to do more, and you will become true and understanding and free and, like Daniel, a faithful, strong, true servant of God. Amen.